Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
When there is a downturn, not all of your competitors will be positioned as such. And some of them, unfortunately, won't survive, especially how severe this pandemic is, you know, the economic crisis it's created. Not all of your competitors are going to make it. If we are in a position of strength, that provides an opportunity for us, because if they go out of business, now we have some market share that we may be able to help. We can help those clients that now lost their service provider, as well as if they're going out of business and they have trucks and they say, we're liquidating the business. We have trucks. Do you want a truck? And you can buy a truck for 30 cents on the dollar, 40 cents on the dollar, which creates a huge economic opportunity as you come out of the downturn.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with referral coach and author of Radical Relevance, Bill Cates, and former lead solo pilot of the Blue Angels and developer of the Fearless Success System, John Foley, then do check them out. They're really worth a listen, but check out today's conversation first. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Ken Wentworth. Ken is an expert in cash flow and revenue growth. He's the best-selling author of How to Be a Cash Flow Pro and Pathway to Profits. He's host of the Mr. Biz Radio podcast. He's a strategic partner who works with business owners to help them operate more profitably and more efficiently. He's often quoted and appears as an expert on small business topics in a variety of written and online publications, including Forbes, American Express, Fast Company, NBC, ABC, Fox, Business News Daily, among others. In our discussion today, Ken talked to me about how to keep track of your business cash flow in real time and shared some tips to improve it. He explained that keeping your key goal visible in prominent places and how that helps him focus. And we talked about why you should think like a three-year-old. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Ken Wentworth. Hi, I'm your host Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome today to the InnovaBuzz podcast all the way from Columbus, Ohio in the USA, Ken Wentworth, who's an on-demand CFO, Chief Financial Officer, for those that are not familiar with the terminology, a cash flow expert, he's a speaker, and he's also a best-selling author of the books Pathway to Profits and How to Be a Cash Flow Pro, and he also has his own radio show and podcast. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Ken. It's a real privilege to have you here as my guest.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on, Jürgen. I've been looking forward to it ever since we got this set up a while back.
Yeah, great. And we got it set up through Dr. Gleb Sapirsky, who was our guest on episode 271 of the InnovaBuzz podcast. He suggested that we have a conversation with you, Ken. So a big hello to Gleb.
Yes. Yeah, no, he's been on my show as well. And that's where it kind of all started. And that's when he reached out to me and said, hey, this is a show you might want to be on. So I think I would really appreciate him introducing us.
Yeah. All right. Now, Chief Financial Officer on demand, but before we talk about all things finance and cash flow, I know cash flow is a big thing that you talk about a lot. Tell us a little bit about your background. Give us a whistle-stop tour of how you got to where you are today and what shaped that journey.
Yeah. So I started out, as a kid growing up in a small 100%, almost 100% blue collar steel mill town in a small town in Eastern Ohio here in the USA. And, I was the first person in my family that went to college to get a degree. And, it's funny looking back at that. When I was in seventh or eighth grade, you know, as a young boy, I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to do what my dad did. Well, my dad worked in the steel mill, and my dad kept telling me as a youngster, you don't want to do this. Like, this is not the thing. Well, my father worked in the steel mill, my grandfather, my uncles, like everyone in my family, all the males worked in the mill. So I thought, this is what you're supposed to do. Well, when I was in seventh or eighth grade, my dad snuck me into the mill and showed me some of the unsavory parts of the job and and what it entails. And I think at first I, kind of thought some of the things were cool. But then he kept taking me to, more treacherous places within the plant and everything until finally, I'm thinking back that he probably got the nonverbal astonished look on my face that he was looking for. Then to ask me, do you still want to work in the steel mill? And I'm like, maybe not. And he told me back then, I'll never forget this. He said, you want to have a job where you work with your brain, not your back. Because he said, this job might be great when you're in your 20s, maybe even your 30s. It starts to catch up with you in your 40s and your 50s. You're miserable from the physical toll it takes. A lot of them are very labor intensive jobs in that. So went to school, got my undergrad degree. Actually came here to Columbus, Ohio for my undergrad degree. Got my undergrad in accounting. Got out of that and started working at a Fortune 15 company. I was very fortunate coming out of school. And so I worked at JP Morgan Chase for 20 plus, Juergen. We don't have to be super specific, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to date myself too much. Worked there for 20 plus years, had a fantastic career, loved it there, great relationships, but I just had reached a point, and I'd gotten to the top 3% of people in the company. There's 260,000 employees at the time, and I was in the top 3%, and I was about to be promoted to the top 1%. And it was ironically enough, Juergen, at that meeting that I when I left that meeting, I decided that I was going to resign. And I had,
how did that come about?
Yeah. So I had two revenue generating ideas that within about a 3 or 4 month period had been shelved because of red tape, bureaucracy, a lot of the stereotypical things you hear about a large company. And I had experienced that in the past a bit, but I'd always been able to somehow manage my way through that. And unfortunately, at that time, I was at a level of the company where it was a lot more difficult to manage through those hurdles. And it just, after the second time, it was just very frustrating to me. And I thought, gosh, I know I could be making a larger impact. I know I could be helping more people. And this is proof positive to me that it's not going to happen here. So I need to figure out something else. And so literally, I've mentioned this before, but I was on the 48th floor. I was in my boss's office in the 48th floor in Midtown Manhattan, New York City. And on the elevator ride from the 48th floor down to the first floor, because I was leaving the building to go to my next meeting, is when I decided I was going to leave. I was going to resign and leave. Now, I will say it's 48 floors, kind of long, and plus there's stops in between. So it's probably sounds a little quicker than it was, but it still was, to make a decision like that, it was still pretty quick. And that's one thing, and I've always been very decisive, and I make a decision and I charge ahead. And so I did that. A funny side note to that piece of the story is I got to the airport in New York City. I'm sitting at LaGuardia and I called my wife and she said, how'd everything go today? And I said, Mark's going to promote me to be in the top 1% of people in the company. And she said, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. You know, all your hard work. And I said, and by the way, I'm going to leave. And she said, you mean your plane's leaving? You have to get off the phone? I said, no, I'm going to resign. And there was a long pause at the other end of the phone. And my wife said, "Did you get to the airport early? Have you been drinking?" And I said, no, actually. And she said, "Well, let's just talk about when you get home." And then once I got home, and we talked through it, and she sort of understood. And the funny part, and so my wife is a nurse, complete non-business, you know, whatsoever. And she said, "Well, I understand what you mean. And I, you know, everything you said makes a lot of sense." She said, "So what are you going to do?" And I said, "I have no idea." And so again, I have the astonished look from my wife, like, "Well, how can you just quit a great job, a lucrative career, when you don't even know what you're going to do next?" I just had the confidence that I knew I would figure it out. I knew there was something bigger. I knew I could figure it out. And so that's what I did. So I met with my mentor. We sort of went through everything, figured it out. And he said, "I think this is what you need to do." And I didn't even know what I do now as an on-demand or fractional CFO. I didn't even know what that was, because I was so wrapped up in the corporate world. I was very naive to the small business world. And so once he explained it to me, it made perfect sense. And so I went out and got my first client, and I was probably, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks in to that assignment that with that client. And I came home, I was driving home, and it was just like this complete aha epiphany moment that this, without a doubt, is what I'm on earth right now to be doing. It was such a fulfilling, you know, moment. And I absolutely love what I do. And it's that cliche of, I don't feel like I work, because I enjoy what I do so much that it's not work for me. I look forward to, I get out of bed in the morning and I'm not thinking, "Oh my gosh, I got to do X, Y, and Z." I think, "Holy crap, I get to go do X, Y, and Z," because I just love it so much. So that's a sort of a long, probably answer of what you asked, but hopefully a little bit insightful.
I think that transformation that you get to when you have that realization, that's quite amazing, isn't it? Because I know from my own experience, I mean, I had, and shall we say, 20 plus years, so I don't date myself, in the corporate world. And most of that, I mean, again, like you, I was really lucky. Most of that I really enjoyed. I loved working with clients. I was traveling a lot and loved experiencing different cultures and interacting with different people all over the place. But probably the last couple of years, there were lots of things going on within the company, lots of politics barriers that were coming up that I have started feeling, oh, you know, this is like, it's really tearing on me now. And I think, you know, in hindsight, I think there was starting to be some value conflicts there. And I spent probably those 2 years transformed in a negative sense, from the point of view of really excited to get to work when I got up in the morning to, "Oh no, I have to go to work today. I'd really rather do anything else." And at some point I realized I've got to do something. It was probably not quite as quick as a 48-story elevator ride, but I did come to the realization and then started heading out. So I think, you know, it's a great story, because I think the transformation when you suddenly realize this is what I'm here to do and I really love doing this is great.
And I should go back. So that decision was a overall a quick decision right from the 48th floor. However, I should mention that I finished my master's degree in 2006. And I told myself then, so the company paid for me to do my additional schooling. And in order for me not to have to repay it, I had to stay there for at least 2 years. And so I gave myself then 2008, I have until 2006, I have until 2008 to decide what I want to do. And I've always had that desire, but I loved my corporate career so much. But even back then, I gave myself that 2 years. I said, I have 2 years to figure this out. And in 2008, I'm going to resign and I'm going to go do my thing. I'm going to start a company. I'm going to do whatever. And then, as you all know, you know, 2008, 2009, the economic downturn happens, and I got to do a lot of really cool things. I got tapped on the shoulder to clean up a lot of messes, which a lot of people say that doesn't sound cool. To me, it was cool. I got a lot of a great experience through that entire thing. So I just continued on. So while that ultimate decision was very quick, there was a lot leading up to it, because here it was. That was in 2015 when I made that decision to resign. So it had been a long time in the works, frankly, but that was just sort of almost the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. Like, okay, this, it's time now. I have to do this and I have to figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. You mentioned you had a mentor at the time. So was that an external person that was mentoring you?
Yeah. And honestly, I'm a little bit embarrassed to admit this, Jürgen, but I honestly didn't really have a mentor prior to that. I was a mentor to many people at JP Morgan Chase, but I didn't really have a mentor myself. I had a very close relationship with my boss at the time, but it wasn't really a mentor. And so once I started trying to figure out what am I going to do next? And it just so happened, I wasn't even looking for a mentor, although in hindsight, I should have been. It was a close friend of mine. It was his good friend's father. And he said, you need to go meet with him. And I was talking with him to explore some different opportunities in a commercial real estate space. Had nothing to do with mentoring or anything like that. We sat down and started talking through commercial real estate and if that was a direction I wanted to go in, et cetera. And the funny part about it was he literally looked at me and said, Ken, you're too smart for this. He said, you'll be bored. You don't want to work here. You'll be bored here. And so he said, but I want to help you figure out what it is. And I mean, the guy is an absolutely fantastic person. So it sort of took me under his wing as a mentee and has helped me tremendously. Super successful guy, but just, you know, without me even asking, offered up for him to be able to help me. And he's very good at it. And he's been extremely helpful for me as I've, you know, gotten into the second phase of my career and you know, had to, some of these twists and turns as you have as an entrepreneur. He's been extremely helpful.
Yeah. Well, I think there's great advice there for everybody. I think, you know, having a mentor that gives an outside perspective and can challenge you in some ways, but also highlight things that perhaps you don't see, like the example of the commercial real estate, which obviously interested you, but he had a different perspective and was able to kind of hold up a mirror in some way.
And honestly, I'll tell you, Jürgen, without his help, I feel like at some point I probably would have gotten to what I do now, but it may have taken me 2, 3, 4, 5 years to figure it out. Right. It would have taken me some wrong turns in the road and going down some detours to get there. He helped me get there much quicker because again, I had no idea what I do now was even a thing. I was completely naive to it. So he helped guide me to that very expeditiously. So it helped accelerate that, you know, this new phase of my career. So I'm extremely grateful for that.
All right. Well, let's talk about what it is you do specifically today and why you do it.
Yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, and you know, a lot of people say, you know, fractional CFO, on-demand CFO, what is that? In a nutshell, what I like to tell people is I help business owners operate their businesses more profitably and more efficiently, which leads to them sleeping better at night. Everyone can relate to that, right? You know, as a business owner, think of it this way. A lot of business owners are really, really good at whatever it is they do, the product they produce, the services they provide. Even think of it, you know, from a law firm, an attorney could be a really good attorney, but maybe they're not as well versed on the business side of things. And so that's where I can help them. There could be someone who's running a manufacturing company who's really, really good at creating widgets, but they just don't understand and they've been exposed to the, you know, the full gamut of the business side of things and how to run a business as profitably and as efficiently as possible, which again, just leads to better sleep at night, right? You have a stronger balance sheet, you have a stronger company. You don't have to worry about, oh my gosh, I have payroll in 6 days and am I going to get enough money in the door to be able to make payroll and things like that. I mean, getting through those things. And that's, as you mentioned at the outset, cash flow is a big part of that. I figured that out very quickly. I mean, obviously without cash flow, you don't have a business. So a very important aspect there. And that's what led me to write that first book and it wasn't even intended to be a book. As I was working with clients and gathering, I wanted to have basically a repository of all these cash flow tips that I had been providing for various clients. And so I just kept adding on to this document. And the next thing you know, it got to be pretty large. And my brother prompted me and he said, you basically have written a book. I said, no, it's not a book. Mm-hmm. And he said, you got it. Cause my intention was just to hand it out to clients as a reference tool, essentially. And my brother said, you gotta publish this thing. You gotta, you know, get this thing out there. And I said, I don't even want to bother with it. Well, thankfully I listened to him, and I put it out there and lo and behold, it became a bestseller. And just sort of by accident, I wasn't promoting it or anything like that. And, that prompted me. It's funny, you know, how success, as they say, success breeds success. So once that, and by the way, I should mention, Jürgen, I absolutely cannot stand writing. I hate to write, which sounds funny, right? But in under the guise of success breeds further success, once that book was so well received, it made me, the wheels started to spin in my head. And I thought, well, I've got a lot more. Like I could, there's more there, right? There's more I should put on in print. And it made me think of, you know, kind of the overall grand scheme of things and how I think about businesses. You want to be able to reach people. And it's almost like, I almost look at it, especially in the role that I have, of it's almost like being an educator, right? If you're a teacher standing or a professor standing in front of a class, everyone in that class, different people learn in different ways and receive information in different ways. Some people have to be demonstrated. Some people have to be more hands-on. Some people need to just read it on their own. And so that made me think, gosh, I've been sort of closed-minded. So I do a lot of video content and things like that and share in that way. And obviously a lot of one-on-one things, but gosh, a lot of people may want to just have a book to be able to digest at their own pace and their own speed. And so that's another way I can help people and help reach them, those folks that learn best that way. That's another way for me to reach them. So that's what prompted me to write the two books. And I've got a third book that's in draft form at this point that we'll release. We've probably got another 3 or 4 months of editing and things like with that one. But and then I have an outline of a fourth book that I'll be doing, but I'll give myself a little time in between here before I get that fourth one out. But yeah. And again, for someone who doesn't even like to write, here we are, you know?
So do you sit down and write these things or how do you put them together?
A great question, especially after I just told you, I don't like to write and you're probably thinking I must be insane. Yeah. Someone I follow on social media who is a marketing person, his name is Frank Kern, gave me this idea. So it's definitely not an original idea, but my hack to writing is that I will sit down with a topic and I will outline. So if whatever the topic is, and then I will just brainstorm an outline of things I want to cover. And then I hit record and I do an audio recording of myself. Mm-hmm. Then I have that. I have an AI app that I use that transcribes it for me. I get it back. I edit the transcription and that becomes my book.
Yeah. 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 I was interested because that's pretty much how I write most of my articles. I haven't quite gotten to a book stage yet. I think I probably need to do that. I need to take your brother's advice. But certainly, you know, I mean, I quite enjoy writing, but I'd still struggle with it. And also my writing, because I've got a scientific background, my writing tends to be very scientifically formal, if mm-hmm. you like, whereas it's not the way I speak. So by recording my voice from a bullet point list, it comes out the way I speak. So it's my voice.
And it's interesting. And I didn't even think of this as a sort of a tangential benefit to writing a book or creating a book in that manner, is that my second book, Pathway to Profits, had a professionally reviewed. And the person said, literally in the review, this book is different than so many business books because I felt like Ken was talking to me across the desk. And yeah. not talking at yeah. me, but talking with me. And so I thought, well, yeah, I actually was. And I'll tell you, Jürgen, another little secret of mine, when I do this, I will have a picture next to my laptop. So I am looking yeah. at someone like I'm having a conversation, that I find that helps me be more conversational mm-hmm. and less academic or more technical, as you mentioned. I think yeah. at least for me, that helps tremendously.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that helps tremendously too. Someone gave me that tip a little while ago. It was actually on the podcast. I can't recall right now who it was. It was probably several years ago now, but I thought, yeah, that's a great idea. And it certainly does work. I agree with you. Mm. And I use that when I do videos now too.
Yeah, same thing here.
Yeah. Mm. All right. Now, tell us a little bit about, you know, we talked cash flow very briefly early on. Tell us a little bit, what are some of the big cash flow risks and traps that people fall into in small business?
I mean, honestly, probably the first one I would mention is that I think, and what I've found with working with clients and speaking with business owners, not just in the US here, but all over the world, is most business owners honestly don't understand cash flow. They think cash flow is synonymous with income, and it's not. Mm. You could have income and have cash flow troubles. You can look great on the cash flow side, but actually be losing money. And again, when I say those things, people go, that doesn't make any sense at all to me, which is all the more reason you need to understand cash flow. And the simplest way for me to describe it, and I think it's people have received this very well and said, oh my gosh, that makes perfect sense to me, is think of cash flow, forget about earnings and revenue and all these other elements to it. Just think of cash flow as money coming into and out of your checking account. That is, in the most bare brass tactics, that's what cash flow is. It's when money's coming in, when it's going out. And most of it has to do with the timing of it. So again, on an income statement, it may show that you're making money, but it may be you have all the expense up front. So you had to pay for manufacturing, you had to pay for raw materials to create your widget. You had to pay for the labor, you had to ship it, you had all these other expenses. And then maybe your sales cycle is 4 months long. So you had all that expense in month one. Well, you're losing money, but through 4 months, once you sell it all, you have net income. And so everything looks great. But in those first three months before you get the revenue, you may not be able to pay all your bills. And so it looks, it becomes a little, and that's an extreme example, but just to sort of illustrate it as clearly as possible, is that's really what it boils down to. And so it's all about timing, when the money's coming into your account, your checking account, and when it's leaving. And so it really, when you break it down and, you know, simplify it to that level, I think that's when people can start to wrap their mind around it and say, oh, okay, so how can I get money in faster? And how can I delay when money leaves? I mean, essentially, that's what we're trying to do to optimize cash flow. And so there's a whole litany of ways to do that, of course. But in the long and short of it, I think, again, as I talk with business owners, they know that that's something they should know. But when I press them on, yeah, I understand. And I'll say, okay, well, you know, give me your understanding of what, you know, how does cash flow work? And then I get some crazy answer that's, you know, maybe not necessarily very accurate. And again, I think it's one of those things that people as owners know that they should know it, but they may not quite understand it. And they're embarrassed to even ask because they're thinking, oh my gosh, I should know this. And I don't even want to ask.
It's the basics, right? Yeah. And I don't really know, so I won't embarrass myself.
Right.
Hmm. All right. Well, in terms of cash flow, then what kind of things can people put in place to manage it? How do you measure it? How do you kind of keep track of it on an ongoing basis?
You know, you absolutely have to track it. And it's funny, I've had more than one business owner, unfortunately, when I began to work with them, they would measure the health of their business, not only the cash flow, but the overall financial health based on their checking account balance. And I just mentioned that, right? But that's not all. That doesn't give you a full picture. That does help with cash flow, right? Because you know if you have the money or not. But that doesn't. You have no idea of anything else in your business if it's running efficiently and as profitably as it should be. So, measuring cash flow. And again, I tell people, you know, of course, in the financial statements, there's a statement of cash flows. I'll tell you, Jürgen, even for me with an accounting undergrad and I have a master's in financial management, I don't even pay attention to statement of cash flow. It's especially to someone who's not, you know, classically trained, as they say, on the financial side of things. It's, as a lot of my clients say, that's accounting mumbo jumbo. I don't understand that. And so more so it's measuring. I mean, literally cash flow, really, we do look at the checking account of the business and when things are going out and coming in. And then we break it down. So I'll take a month statement and I'll put the ins and the outs and the timing of them, day one, day two, day three, 30 days worth, and show them the fluctuation of their balance every single day. And all of a sudden that usually becomes sort of that epiphany, that aha of, oh my gosh, I never thought about it that way. So yeah, for the month I made $10,000, but days 10 through 13, I had a negative balance in my checking account. I had a cash flow problem, even though the full 30 days I'm fine. So it's all about timing with cash flow. So that's particularly important. And I'll tell you just real quick as a sort of a side note to that, one of the easy ways to help with that is, or two easy ways. First of all, get your invoices out right away. As soon as you provide a service for someone, get an invoice out. You can offer some incentives for them to pay you earlier, for example. And maybe you give them a little bit of a discount if they pay you within 10 days, as opposed to, I know a lot of times in a lot of industries, the standard is a net 30. So they have to pay you within 30 days, getting that money in a little bit quicker. And I'll tell you, the number one thing I help people with cash flow that makes an almost immediate benefit is credit cards. Now, it's not only accepting credit cards, and I know a lot of people say, well, gosh, everyone accept credit cards. It's, you know, it's 2020. Well, actually they don't. There's about a third of the businesses overall globally do not accept credit cards. And it's a terrible mistake. Mm. And the people who I've run into that don't accept credit cards say, I don't want to pay the 2% or 3% fee or whatever. And I can quickly illustrate to them how that financially doesn't make sense. I haven't run across a business yet to where paying that fee didn't make sense, because it helps your cash flow tremendously. And the other, on the flip side of that, is you can help as far as the money going out of your account is utilizing a business credit card for your expenses. Now, I have to preface that by saying I'm not suggesting to finance your business with credit cards. I don't mean that at all. You pay your balance every single month. Otherwise, this doesn't work. But so think of it this way. In that example I gave earlier with a manufacturer that they have to buy raw materials on day one, obviously, before they can produce their widget. So they buy those raw materials on day one. They come into the plant, they create the widget, and they sell it. So it takes them how long to do that? Well, if they pay for that widget with a credit card, they're going to get the invoice sometime later, maybe a couple of weeks later. The invoice will be due in 30 days. So now you got another 30 days. And what I tell people, and some people don't like this advice, and I've been criticized on this, and some, so it's a little bit polarizing, but if someone gives me a net 30 invoice and there is no financial incentive for me to pay earlier, I pay on day 29. Because my stance is, if you wanted me to pay earlier, you should have asked for that. And I don't mean that in a facetious way. I just mean, that's just part of doing business. And so I suggest to pay it on day 29, but pay it with a business credit card. And depending on your billing cycle, that may be another 30 or to 45 days out before you have to actually lay the cash, again, cash coming out of your checking account. So you've paid your invoice with a business credit card, but that has nothing to do with your checking account. You haven't laid any cash out. So in that scenario I just gave you with buying that raw material on day one and utilizing a business credit card, when you actually have to pay the balance, you could have anywhere from 60 to 75 days from the time you got the raw material on day one until the cash actually leaves your checking account. Now think about how powerful that is from a cash flow perspective. When, you know, as I mentioned, it's all about timing. And so in those 60 to 75 days, you have likely created that widget, you know, put it for sale, sold it, and got the revenue into your account. So now you've already got the money before you've actually paid for the materials for, you know, for that widget. So that is a super powerful way. And then, as I mentioned, as far as accepting credit cards, people will pay you much quicker. Even when you have someone where, if you have a process in place where you're working on your accounts receivable, and someone's late and you have a process where once they're one day late, right, day 31, someone in your company may work those and make phone calls. Think about how easy it is to say on the phone call, Jürgen, we have an invoice here. I just want to let you know you're a day late. If it's convenient for you, I can just take a payment via credit card right now over the phone and we can just make this go away. The vast majority of the time people go, oh my gosh, I completely forgot. Yes, let me give you a credit card and it's done. As opposed to, oh yeah, I'll get it. I'll send you a check, and then they may forget again, and or they delay a couple of days. They finally send the check. It takes a couple of days to get to you. again, speaking of timing, you've now delayed it even further, right? You've added another, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 10 days to the process. Whereas you take that payment with a credit card, boom, you got the money instantly. Everything's taken care of. You don't have to continue to follow up with that account. So a whole bunch of different ways and advantages to benefits to using those. But that's one of the absolute things that someone can implement right away and have a massively favorable impact on their cash flow.
Yeah, well, I certainly use credit card exactly the way you describe it. One of the things that I find challenging, though, and I'm interested to get your advice on this, is so I've paid all my bills on time. I tend to do exactly what you say. If it's 30 days, I'll pay it on day 29. Actually, I follow Mike Michalowicz's principle. So I have my bill payment days on the 10th and the 25th. So I look at what's due in the next 14 days. And I'll pay that on that particular day. But what I find a little bit challenging is keeping track of how much debt do I have on my credit card that needs to be paid off when the credit card payment date is due, and how do I kind of keep the cash flow balance at a level that's always covered.
Yeah, and it's a great question. And it's an important aspect to this whole strategy, frankly, because as I mentioned, if you get to a point where you just go crazy and you're charging everything on a credit card and you're not paying attention to it, it becomes due and you don't have enough money to pay it. Again, you've defeated some of the benefits mitigated some of the benefits of this whole strategy. So what I suggest for people is most businesses have some recurring expenses that happen every month that are mostly fixed. You know that your XYZ bill is roughly $250 a month. Now, as it comes in and you pay it with a credit card, you can see it. Was it 250 or around 250? Okay, I'm going to be fine. I know that. So really, what I do with my clients is we sort of strategize and say, okay, we're going to pay these 12 different expenses with a credit card. Now, we know those expenses on a given month should be at, let's say, they're $20,000 for those 12 things. So now we know, as long as we're kind of within a reasonable tolerance range for each of those individual expenses, we know when the bill comes, it's going to be around $20,000, which we know we can afford in this example. And so that's the easiest way to do that without having to, of course, there's ways, I mean, you can go out and look. I mean, things are so much easier now than they were a gazillion years ago, as far as going out and looking at with your bank's app or going online and looking at your bank. But from an efficiency perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense, right? You don't want to go out and keep checking that and drive yourself crazy. Yeah. So that's what we do, is we kind of strategize and say, okay, these, you know, 12 bills that we get on invoices that we get on a regular basis, we're going to do those. And then as we go along, we may add more to the mix, but we kind of know generally those things we charge what they are. And then as we pay them individually, we make sure that it's around where we expected it to be. And if not, you need to make a note somehow to say, hey, I'm running about, you know, $600 over what I expect for the month. Is that okay or not? And the other side benefit, and I'm sure you're going to mention this as well, especially if you utilize this strategy, is think of the benefits you get, the rewards, right? This is a completely side benefit to the strategy. But so, for example, I had a client, this has been a couple years ago now, but he ran a small remodeling company. And so he would spend about $400,000 a year on materials for jobs. So we began to use I'm not affiliated with any particular credit card company, but there is one out there that has no spending limit and gives you 2% cash back with no limit. There's no annual fee, completely just 2%. And you won't have to search very far to find it. So think of that. $400,000, he gets a free $8,000 every year just by using that credit card. And it helps his cash flow, and he gets $8,000. That particular client, although he was very thankful how much I helped him, he did something not very nice, Jürgen. He took that $8,000 and he took his wife on vacation to Hawaii. I didn't know that. I just knew he was going on vacation. He sent me a picture from the beach, and he's holding a beer in his hand, and you can see the ocean in front of him and sand. And he said, "Thanks a lot, Mr. Biz. I use my rewards for this." I'm thinking, I told him, I said, you better bring me back one of those t-shirts that say, Mr. Biz helped me get this. And all he got was a stinky, crappy t-shirt or what, you know, however they.
Yeah, that's great advice. I'll have to go and look for that. certainly, yeah, you can utilize the rewards. And here in Australia, it might be slightly different. I know some of my credit cards, my personal one certainly has some really good reward system, and that works quite well for me too. All right. Now, I mean, as we're talking at the moment, we're in the middle, hopefully on over the peak of the COVID pandemic crisis and maybe coming down into the valley of after COVID, but who knows? So what's been your experience in terms of the impact of the on the economy of the COVID pandemic and the shutdowns that we've had, and how that's impacted businesses and what they can do to be more resilient, particularly around the area of cash flow when, you know, they've probably lost business in various ways?
Yeah, no, I think, and who knew at the time, and again, of course, I'm not a scientist and didn't know anything about any of this stuff, but I hope even just globally that we've all, government leaders, et cetera, have learned from some of this as far as the absolute detrimental impact that financially this has had to the economy. And maybe perhaps if this happens again, something similar to this, that we have maybe learned from this and some of the trials and tribulations we've experienced globally, and maybe have a better approach next time. I'm really hoping that a lot of our leaders around the world are considering those things. But I'll tell you, and this isn't a very popular answer, Jürgen, but I'll say, and I don't mean this to be self-aggrandizing or anything, but I began last year in 2019, in May and June of last year, I began, and when I did it, my clients were like, what are you talking about? Preparing for an economic downturn. Now, of course, I had no idea a pandemic was coming. I just knew that economically, the business cycle, we've been on a bull run for a long time. And it's, I wasn't being pessimistic or negative. It's just, that's how the business cycle works. We're going to take a dip. We'll come back up. It's just how it works. And so I began really focusing on positioning my clients. So, and I was positioning them for July 1st of 2020. I said, I don't think an economic downturn will occur that quickly, but I want to be conservative and I want to be ready on July 1st and we'll be good. And I had a whole set of assumptions around it. We'll have an economic downturn. It'll last approximately 24 months. And so what do we need? And so I stress tested the numbers with each one of my clients individually back then to say, okay, so your business does X, Y, and Z. If we had a 30% reduction in revenue, what kind of levers can we pull on the expense side, right? Which things are not fixed and that are variable that we can change and we could, you know, adjust as need be. As revenue begins to dip, we can also lower our expenses. And then where do we reach the sort of the point to where we're down to fixed expenses? And so now we have a problem, right? We have less revenue than we have fixed expenses to pay each month, and began positioning them for that. So again, the reason I say this isn't it's very popular with my clients because they were very happy, not happy, but when the pandemic hit, they said, oh my gosh, thank goodness. You know, and it's funny, one of my clients literally last year called me paranoid. When I said, I want to start talking about this in position, he said, oh my gosh, you're being paranoid. Everything's great. Well, he was the first one to say, oh my gosh, thank goodness you were paranoid, because we positioned ourselves in a position of strength. And as a matter of fact, that client who has a service business, he has a chimney sweep business. You know, one of the primary ways we grow that business, obviously, is having more additional service trucks on the road. And this is exactly what I told him back then. So I look really good now. Some of it's just luck, right? But I told him back then, I said, I want to make sure we're positioned, because when there is a downturn, not all of your competitors will be positioned as such. And some of them, unfortunately, won't survive, especially how severe this pandemic is, you know, the economic crisis it's created. Not all of your competitors are going to make it. If we are in a position of strength, that provides an opportunity for us, because if they go out of business, now we have some market share that we may be able to help. We can help those clients that now lost their service provider, as well as if they're going out of business and they have trucks and they say, we're liquidating the business, We have trucks. Do you want a truck? And you can buy a truck for 30 cents on the dollar, 40 cents on the dollar, which creates a huge economic opportunity as you come out of the downturn, right? And so that's exactly what we've done. And it's, you could have sworn I wrote the book, because that's exactly what happened. His neck, he's the, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, here in the US, and he's the top chimney sweep person in the, you know, global area, the large area around there. His number two competitor already with the pandemic is thrown in the towel. He was not positioned for it, way too much debt, over leveraged. And that's exactly what happened. He called my client and said, "We're going out of business. We're going to liquidate. Do you want any of my assets? I'm trying to monetize some of my assets." And we got a truck for about 40 cents on the dollar, because he said, "I just want to get rid of it." And so we'll have that opportunity to seize that market share. So my long answer to your question, Jürgen, is the key part is to make sure you've positioned your business financially, that you're ready for this. Trying to, and a lot of business, unfortunately, have found this with the pandemic, is trying to make those changes when it happens, especially in this case, because the downturn has been so severe. For a lot of businesses, it's too late. I hate to say that. It pains me, the number of businesses that are going to falter, not just in the US, but globally, that just weren't ready for this. I think things were so good economically for so long, is that, frankly, I think a lot of owners got, for lack of a better phrase, fat, dumb, and happy of, hey, it's always going to be this way. We'll always have boom times. And they didn't prepare themselves for a downturn. And so, you know, they're paying the ultimate price at this point for that. So my answer to the question is you got to make sure you're ready for it. You got to be ready ahead of time, because again, it's something this severe, it's very difficult to try to turn that massive battleship around. You just can't do it quickly enough when it's something this severe.
Yeah, so that it really highlights that contingency planning is so important, isn't it? And you've given us a great example there of what kind of things you might consider in building that sort of contingency plan. All right, well, this has been fabulous, Ken. I could dig in some more on a lot of these things. I think there's some great lessons there, but I'd encourage people to go and check out your website and your books to find out some more. It's a good time now, I think, to move on to The Buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers and inspire our listener to go and do something awesome today.
I hope so.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
To be more innovative, I have an answer that I truly believe, but when I say it initially, it's going to sound probably a little funny, is I think that we all can use a dose of thinking like a three-year-old. And what I mean by that is, think about a time, probably can't remember when you were three, but think about, as an adult, three-year-olds you've been around, and how absolutely inquisitive they are, and how they have no boundaries. They don't know what, you know, we as adults start to put fences around, or you know, they just know endless possibilities, right? And so I think putting yourself in the mindset, and again, it's not the easiest thing to do, but thinking like a three-year-old. I have an advisory council with my businesses, and we literally, every time we have a meeting, we have a section of the meeting that's called Think Like a Three-Year-Old. Really thinking of the endless possibilities that are out there, and you really have to challenge yourself, because again, especially as you get really ingrained in your area of expertise, it's so easy to get that tunnel vision that really begins to limit all of us and hinders our innovative abilities.
Yeah, great advice. I love the calling it think like a three-year-old, because it kind of makes it a game, and it makes it okay, because one of the things I know about three-year-olds, and I can remember when I was a young fella, I vaguely remember some things from being a three-year-old myself, but I can remember when I was maybe 10 and so, and had three-year-olds around me and family and extended friendships, and I remember the one thing about them that stands out for me still today is why? Why? And I stop asking why.
And that's exactly what I mean. Yeah. And that's right. When I was thinking originally, I was like, is it think like a 2-year-old? Is it a 4-year-old? Is it 3? And I'm thinking, I'm like, I think 3 is about the right spot of the endless questions of why, which is perfect, is perfect. And so when we have that section, when we have an advisory council meeting with my businesses, that's what we do. And so someone will say, well, I got an idea. What if you did this? And I'll say, why? And someone else will say, why? And so we end up, you know, it spurs, I think, at least for us, it spurs that innovation to continually question why and to think about, you know, again, to really force you to be more innovative, I think.
Yeah, well, we have this method that we use. We based on the 5 whys method. I can't remember now where it actually comes from. I can't claim credit for it, but we certainly use it. And I have to be really careful when I apply that to somebody if I haven't told them beforehand, here's what we're going to do, because they think you're being a pain, you know, after the second why. So that's why I like the idea of, you know, calling it a think like a 3-year-old session, because it gives you permission to ask why as many times as you want.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
The best thing is probably what I alluded to is our advisory council. And we have that. And so I would tell everyone, so not just that we have that think like a 3-year-old, but having an advisory council, I think, is extremely important. And I found this in working with business owners. And sometimes I feel like they don't have it because honestly, there may be a little bit of an ego there thinking that I don't need an advisory council. I got this. But what I think is very important is 2 things with an advisory council. Number one, you have to have regularly scheduled meetings. It's too easy to get too busy and not have it. Oh, we're going to have one next quarter, and next quarter comes and goes. Everyone's busy. It never happens. The other thing is, it's just being courteous to your board members that they know during the year when those meetings are exactly, so they can plan for it in their schedule to ensure you have proper attendance. But the second thing I'll say about advisory council that I found is absolutely the most important one is that what I found at least is that we as people, we hire folks this way. And we in that case have, you know, board members, council members that are similar. You inherently look for people that are like you. However, for an advisory council or a board, that is, the, in my opinion, the absolute wrong thing to do. You already have your opinions. Yeah. You know how you do things. You want to find people that have a complete varied background and frankly, varied personalities. I have one person on my advisory council who I literally call him Cynical Sam. and I think it's good. And we have balance, right? If you have all cynical people, right? Nothing ever gets done because everyone always poo-poos all the ideas. But I think it's good to have that cynic voice there to say, wait a minute, guys, you haven't thought about this. Now, sometimes we say, you're missing the point here, right? But other times he brings something up and we're like, oh my gosh, you're right. We hadn't even thought about that. So it's very important. I have someone who's an artist on my advisory council. I'm sure you know the type, Jürgen, that just mind, you know, that everything, their mind is just, it's thinks so much differently than mine, which is what makes them so valuable, because they bring a completely different perspective, non-business. They don't, and that's the thing, the checks and balances within the council is that this particular art person, they don't care about anything financial. They don't care, is this going to make money? They don't care, right? They're like, oh, you need to build it and, you know, put this and, you know, have a mural over here, and which is helpful though. So now the business minds on the council can say, oh, that's a fantastic idea. How can we make that work? Can we make that profitable? Can we make it, you know, have a good ROI with that? So that's really, really important, I think, with an advisory council, is make sure you don't have people who have personalities and even backgrounds like yourself, because to me, you get too much into the groupthink and innovation just gets absolutely squashed.
Yeah, that's great. I love that. And it comes back to what you're saying earlier with the think like a 3-year-old being really expansive. Mm-hmm. So you've got, you know, so many different perspectives bringing in ideas that are a lot more expansive than if everybody was the same or if you were just operating on your own.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
As far as especially productivity, I have a resource I use that is I honestly haven't found another resource like this. So I've used CRM systems, customer relationship management systems in the past, but I stumbled upon one about 4 or 5 months ago, I guess it's been now. It was around the end of 2019. It's a CRM system, but it's like, it has all the bells and whistles of a CRM system, and it also has a project management element to it. So for me, when you combine the two of those, because I've used project management systems and I've used CRM systems, and sometimes they don't talk to each other very well.
Yeah.
This particular system, and it's called Pulse is what it's called. I think the website's thepulsespot.com. And it's very inexpensive. And it is absolutely fantastic. Like I said, it's got all of the awesome parts of CRM as well as project management. And obviously getting those two to talk together is huge. There's even aspects to it. And it's not as strong in this area, but it even has aspects of marketing to where you can see different campaigns you've used with folks on the CRM side, who has seen what, who hasn't seen what, as far as any of your advertising or maybe your email offers and all that kind of stuff. It's fantastic. And I want to say it's less than $100 US dollars. I think it's even like maybe $50. Very inexpensive. Oh my gosh. It pays for itself in the first, 2 days of the month. It's already paid for itself because it saves me so much time.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I'm not familiar with that one, so I'll have to go and check it out. Yeah. But you're right. That's always been something that frustrates me, still does, having the project management system not talking to your CRM and, you know, having to kind of figure out some hacks to do that. And then, you've got all these manual things you have to do and keep track of, and inevitably some things fall through the cracks there.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's why when I stumbled onto this and I saw, and I can't even remember, I think a colleague of mine sent it to me and said, hey, you got to check this out. And as I recall, I went to the website and it claims all these things, right? Oh, we do this and we have that. And I thought, okay, I've been there before, right? And then I got in and actually got a little more interested and saw, I think they had a couple of videos that demonstrated some things. And then I scheduled a demo with the company and they started walking me through this. And I'm like, wait a minute, you mean I can do this and this and this? And they're like, oh yeah, everything's all integrated. I'm like, sign me up, take my credit card, let's go,
Yeah. Yeah, great. All right. Well, speaking of CRMs and project management, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
The number one way, and I use this with myself, as you mentioned, with projects, even goals, is creating the proper level of accountability. And with clients, I use that, obviously every one of my clients has a budget, and we track against that budget. We review it every single month. And that creates a level of accountability. So they know we're going to have that meeting every month. And so, to see what the progress we've made or where we need to make changes and things like that. But I think that accountability is just extremely important, whether it be, again, with, you're having regular meetings with the client or customer. But, one of the ways I do it, like for myself with goals is, and this may sound really silly, but I promise you it'll cost you less than $2 US dollars. And for me, I've used this, in every aspect of my life. When I have a goal, I will buy those little 3x5 index cards. And I will write typically either a number or one word on those index cards. And I'll have maybe 4, 5, 6 of them. Now I take those index cards and I put the first one on the mirror. I tape it to the mirror above my sink in our bathroom. So every morning when I get up and I'm brushing my teeth and I'm shaving and I'm combing my hair, whatever, brushing my hair, I see it. So it's a constant reminder. I will put one on the dashboard in my truck. So now when I'm driving, I have another reminder. I will put another one in my office near my monitor, hanging off the bottom of my monitors. So now I have a reminder there. I can't escape it. So whatever it is, I cannot escape it. Now, again, you can't have, 8 different ones, right? If you have one primary goal or thing that you're trying to accomplish, it's been very, very powerful. And it constantly, you can't escape it. It's always there. It's a constant reminder because it's sometimes easy. Let's say you had a goal or a project you're working on that may be a 6-month project, well, it's difficult to stay on track and motivated for those 6 months. So how do you do that? And for me, this is a powerful one. For example, the one in my truck, if I get in my truck to drive somewhere, I see that. And especially if there's no one else in the vehicle with me, now while I'm driving, I've just been reminded. So now I have 10 minutes or whatever, and I may start thinking about, gosh, what have I done today? You know, what other things can I be doing? And so it constantly gives you that reminder. While you are in the morning mindlessly brushing your teeth, you see it, and the same thing happens. It creates innovation, frankly, in the lowest common denominator form, in that you start to think, at least for me, is, again, what have I done to achieve that goal? What can I be doing? Again, those times with you're inefficiently doing something, or something you have to do, you know, you can sort of multitask while you're brushing your teeth and thinking about that. So that absolutely has been super powerful for me. I used it when I was a competitive power lifter and set world records and things. I would put the record amount, the weight on a card, have those around everywhere as I was training towards that next competition to set that record. So massively powerful for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing I love about that is it forces you to actually focus, because you can't have too many of those post-it notes or check cards, whatever you call them, posted. So it forces you to actually focus on one or two goals or three goals perhaps. And just that focus helps a lot.
Yes, also. Absolutely. Yeah. And you're exactly right. Like when I do it, I literally will only have one goal. Because what I found for me, I start to get too fragmented. If I have, multiple things on that card, I get too fragmented. So I'll focus on one at a time. And that's my main primary goal for that. And so sometimes what I'll do, if you have, let's say, three that you're focusing on or you want to focus on, is think of the next 30 days with the first project. What do you need to get done to really get this thing going in the direction you need it to? And make that for 30 days your index card. Then once you've accomplished that and that thing is going along and going well, now perhaps you can go to the second project and say, okay, what do I need to do for the next 30 days to make sure this thing has success and it gets legs? So, I mean, when I have multiple things, that's typically the way I approach it.
Great advice. I love it. All right. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
To differentiate yourself, I say this all the time, and it's an underlying theme that I use in the content I put out and in dealing, helping clients and things, is make it easy for people to do business with you by doing what your competitors don't do. It's kind of a mouthful, and it sounds kind of obvious and easy, but what I mean by that is don't get stuck in that, as I mentioned earlier, like that sort of that group think or even industry think. So for example, if you're in an industry that typically works with retainers, be willing to do hourly. A thing like that may set you apart, because if they've talked to and they're interviewing three other consultants, let's say, and they all want a retainer, and that particular client is not comfortable with a retainer and you offer hourly. It's a simple example, but something like that is doing things a little bit differently. Offer what I try to do with like Mr. Biz Solutions is try to offer kind of a one-stop shop for your customers in your area of expertise. And it could be complementary services or products. And it doesn't mean that you have to create those, but you can create strategic partnerships with trusted resources. And they have to be trusted resources. But so again, it makes it easy for your folks to do business with you because you're doing things that a competitor doesn't. So for me, for example, an example of this might be, Jürgen, is, you know, I'm a CFO. I'm not an accountant. I mean, my undergrad's in accounting, but I don't do accounting. I'm not a bookkeeper. I don't do any of that stuff. I'm not an attorney. Well, I have very trusted resources. So if someone comes to me and says, I need a bookkeeper, I need someone to close my books, and I need a CFO, I say, I got you. I'll be the CFO part, and I will bring on a resource that will help us that I trust myself on the bookkeeping side. So now they don't have to go hire a bookkeeper and hire me as a CFO and then hope that the two of us mesh together well, right? They come one place and get it. They say, I'm starting a business, and so I need to put together a business plan. I need to file my legal structure documents. I'm not an attorney. I need to get an attorney. I can handle that for you. Let me manage the whole process for you. And again, A lot of my competitors don't do that. They say, I'm a CFO. That's all I do. You're going to have to go hire a bookkeeper, or you're going to have to go hire an attorney. So that's just one example of how to do that without having to create those things yourself, but just make it easy to do business. And what I found, not only in my own business, but with my clients as well, that in most cases will differentiate you, because a lot of people just don't do those things. They focus on, you know, very narrow focus on their business.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a really good point to, you know, focus on making it easy for people to do business with you. And we talked earlier about the pandemic. I've had quite a number of experiences now during the shutdowns where it's become a nightmare to do business with some people, because they were so reliant on the in-person contact. Mm-hmm. And they have no contingencies for, like, doing customer service over remote connections, or, you know, providing means to return products or deliver products. And I keep thinking, I have this term that I learned when I was doing my accreditation for one of the consulting franchises that I started out with, called Waymish. Yeah. Why are you making it so hard?
Okay, I love it.
Yeah. And I keep thinking Waymish so
yeah,
often.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, make it easy to do business with you. It's very powerful.
Yeah, and so even tying back into what I was talking about earlier with credit cards, that is another example of it, is it's make it easy for people to pay you. If you have cash flow problems, make it as easy as possible for someone to pay you. If they can click a couple of buttons and pay you, gosh, that's so much easier than having to write a check and put it in the mail or anything like that. So again, make it easy for people to pay you if you want to help your cash flow as well. So, but I love that, Waymish. That's great. I like that a lot.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Ken. This has been fabulous. Now, where can people find out more about you and learn about your books and the work you do, and maybe even reach out and say thank you for what you've shared with us today?
Yeah, I would honestly encourage everyone. I put out a ton of free content on social media. I have a YouTube channel, Mr. Biz, on Facebook. You can follow Mr. Biz Solutions. We cover a ton of stuff there. Look me up on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter, Instagram. You can find me on all those different places. The books are on Amazon. If nothing else, follow me on social media and just eat up all the free stuff that we put out there, when the videos and all that kind of stuff. And like an old school DJ, I take requests. So I do a lot of videos. And so people will reach out and say, gosh, I'd love for you to do a video about fill in the blank, right? I'm having difficulty hiring folks. And how can I, you know, give me some tips on hiring folks. What are the best ways to do that? Things like that. And so I'll take requests and, you know, do a video. Hey, so-and-so reached out, and so this video is for you, but hopefully it benefits everyone. So yeah, definitely follow us on social media and take advantage of all the free stuff.
Great. Yeah. And I love the taking requests. I mean, that's a wonderful way to generate content, when, you know, often I get people asking me, well, what do I write about if I'm writing a blog post or doing some video or podcasting? And I say, well, what do people ask you? You know, what are they asking you questions about?
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, they're wanting answers. So that would be the first place to go.
Yeah.
I love the requests. Yeah. All right. Do you have some parting advice you'd like to leave our listener today, Ken?
Honestly, the one thing I would mention that we haven't talked about is that, and I'll be brief, I promise, Jürgen. So my three pillars of financial success for businesses, and those are cash flow, which we've talked about that, right? But you got to get your cash flow right first. The second thing is budgeting. I require anyone who wants to work with me, you have to have a budget. If you don't want to have a budget, then we can't work together. That's how powerful they are. and then the third one is pricing. And pricing, it sounds obvious again, because folks say, oh, well, my pricing is good. And I'll tell you, I've never yet worked with a business where we were not able to make changes and optimize their pricing. And I don't mean going in and saying, oh, you need to raise all your prices. I don't mean that at all. What I mean is, a lot of businesses have what I call the silent business killer, and that is unprofitable products or services, or maybe even customers, I call it the silent business killer, because when I mention that to an owner, they go, Ken, we don't have any unprofitable products, services, or customers. I call it silent because you probably do, you just don't know it. And so you're doing business and maybe you're growing and expanding the amount of the volume of business you're doing on that product, service, or customer. And all you're doing is running in quicksand. You're just digging yourself a deeper and deeper hole because you're losing money on that. So getting that pricing nailed down, and that when I start working with a client, those are the three areas we start with first. That's why I call it the pillars. If you get those three pillars correct in your business, everything else can flourish. You can begin to scale. Think about it. If you don't have those right, if your pricing is wrong and you have unprofitable products and you begin to scale, again, you're scaling unprofitably. And that's how you see, occasionally you'll see a business that's, let's say a brick and mortar that has a, you know, maybe it's a restaurant and they have a line out the door. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, you see a for rent sign and you're like, what happened? Like they were so popular. Likely they were scaling unprofitably, right? They were growing and growing and growing, but it was unprofitable because they were just, and as you grow with that unprofitability, it just always makes you more unprofitable. So those three things, my three pillars of financial success, massively important. If you do nothing else as a business owner, you have to make sure those three things are optimized in your business.
Great. Well, it sounds like we might have to get you back on for a couple of extra podcasts later on to talk about the topics we didn't cover today, but certainly I'd encourage people to go and check out your YouTube channel, your Facebook page and other social media for all the videos and content you post, the radio show you host on your website, and also check out the two books that we mentioned earlier, How to Be a Cashflow Pro and Pathway to Profits.
Absolutely.
And keep an eye out for the third book coming soon,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, Pathway to More Profits.
Pathway to More Profits. I like it. Yeah. All right. Well, finally then, Ken, who would you like me to chat with on a future Innova Buzz podcast and why?
Honestly, the person that really pops to mind, and this is probably hopefully will make sense, is his name is Jason Case. He is the owner of the company that I mentioned earlier, my favorite, innovative and productive thing, that system, Pulse. I got to know him. He was, when I first started working with Pulse, he's the one that did the demo and I really enjoyed him and liked him. And so now I've gotten to know him a little bit. He's a fantastic guy and he's very efficiency, innovation, technology focused person. So I think he'd be a really good guest on the show.
Great. All right. Well, we'll reach out to Jason and maybe get an introduction from you and then bring you on the show to have that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be honored.
Well, thanks for sharing your time and your insights and your wisdom so generously with us today, Ken, on the Innova Buzz podcast. I really appreciate this. I've learned a lot about your journey, about cash flow and some tips that you shared with us. I think there's a lot there and looking forward to continuing this conversation. We might have to get you back for some additional discussion around the budgeting process and also the pricing. I think the pricing one is probably a big topic that we could spend quite a bit of time on and even the budgeting one.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, no, I really appreciate you having me on. I had a great time and I hope that this was helpful for everyone.
All right. Well, thanks. All the best for the future and let's keep in touch.
All right. Will do.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that valuable and highly informative conversation with Ken and took something away from his episode. He shared a bunch of valuable tips around cash flow and improving cash flow in times like we find ourselves in now. I also love his advice of make it easy to do business with you. I'm curious to know what you took away from Ken's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/KenWentworth. That is KenWentworth. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/KenWentworth. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Ken there, as well as links to the Mr. Biz Solutions website, his books, his social media pages, the Mr. Biz radio show, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Ken suggested we have a conversation with Jason Case of Pulse CRM on a future Innova Buzz podcast episode. So, Jason, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Ken Wentworth. Tune in again to the next episodes of the Innova Buzz podcast, where we've got even more fantastic guests lined up, including empathy expert Dr. Mark Goulston and copywriter and content creator Christina Torres. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.